angrier he was with us, the more we laughed. Alyosha's vexation and then childish despair reduced us at last to the condition of Gogol's midshipmen, who roared with laughter if one held up one's finger. Mavra, coming out of the kitchen, stood in the doorway and looked at us with grave indignation, vexed that Alyosha had not come in for a good wigging from Natasha, as she had been eagerly anticipating for the last 5 days, and that we were all so merry instead. At last, Natasha, seeing that our laughter was hurting Alyosha's feelings, left off laughing.
"What do you want to tell us?" she asked.
"Well, am I to set the samovar?"
asked Mavra, interrupting Alyosha without the lightest ceremony.
"Be off, Mavra, be off,"
he cried, waving his hands at her in a hurry to get rid of her.
"I'm going to tell you everything that has happened, is happening, and is going to happen, because I know all about it. I see, my friends, you want to know where I've been for the last 5 days. That's what I want to tell you, but you won't let me. To begin with, I've been deceiving you all this time, Natasha. I've been deceiving you for ever so long, and that's the chief thing."
"Deceiving me?"
"Yes, deceiving you for the last month. I had begun it before my father came back. Now the time has come for complete openness. A month ago, before father came back, I got an immense letter from him, and I said nothing to either of you about it. In this letter he told me plainly and simply, and I assure you in such a serious tone that I was really alarmed, that my engagement was a settled thing, that my fiancée was simply perfection. That, of course, I wasn't good enough for her, but that I must marry her all the same, and so I must be prepared to put all this nonsense out of my head, and so on and so on. We know, of course, what he means by nonsense. Well, that letter I concealed from you."
"You didn't,"
Natasha interposed.
"See how he flatters himself. As a matter of fact, he told us all about it at once. I remember how obedient and tender you were all at once, and wouldn't leave my side, as though you were feeling guilty about something, and you told us the whole letter in fragments."
"Impossible. The chief point, I'm sure, I didn't tell you. Perhaps you both guessed something, but that's your affair. I didn't tell you. I kept it secret and was fearfully unhappy about it."
"I remember, Alyosha. You were continually asking my advice and told me all about it, a bit at a time. Of course, as though it were an imaginary case," I added, looking at Natasha.
"You told us everything. Don't brag, please,"
she chimed in.
"As though you could keep anything secret. Deception is not your strong point. Even Mavra knew all about it. Didn't you, Mavra?"
"How could I help it?"
retorted Mavra, popping her head in at the door.
"You told us all about it before 3 days were over. You couldn't deceive a child."
"Phew, how annoying it is to talk to you. You're doing all this for spite, Natasha. And you're mistaken too, Mavra. I remember I was like a madman then. Do you remember, Mavra?"
"To be sure I do. You're like a madman now."
"No, no, I don't mean that. Do you remember we'd no money then, and you went to pawn my silver cigar case? And what's more, Mavra, let me tell you, you're forgetting yourself and being horribly rude to me. It's Natasha has let you get into such ways. Well, suppose I did tell you all about it at the time, bit by bit. I do remember it now, but you don't know the tone of the letter, the tone of it. And the tone was what mattered most in the letter, let me tell you. That's what I'm talking about."
"Why, what was the tone?"
asked Natasha.
"Listen, Natasha, you keep asking questions as though you were in fun. Don't joke about it. I assure you that it's very important. I was in such a tone that I was in despair. My father had never spoken to me like that. It was as though he would sooner expect an earthquake of Lisbon than that he should fail to get his own way. That was the tone of it."
"Well, well, tell us. Why did you want to conceal it from me?"
"Oh, my goodness. Why, for fear of frightening you. I hoped to arrange it all myself. Well, after that letter, as soon as my father came, my troubles began. I prepared myself to answer him firmly, distinctly and earnestly, but somehow it never came off. He never asked me about it. He's cunning. On the contrary, he behaved as though the whole thing were settled and as though any difference or misunderstanding between us were impossible. You hear? Impossible. Such confidence. And he was so affectionate, so sweet to me. I was simply amazed. How clever he is, Ivan Petrovitch. If only you knew. He has read everything. He knows everything. You've only to look at him once, and he knows all your thoughts as though they were his own. That's no doubt why he has been called a Jesuit. Natasha doesn't like me to praise him. Don't be cross, Natasha. Well, so that's how it is. Oh, by the way, at first he wouldn't give me any money, but now he has. He gave me some yesterday. Natasha, my angel, our poverty is over now. Here, look, all he took off my allowance these last 6 months to punish me, he paid yesterday. See how much there is. I haven't counted it yet. Mavra, look what a lot of money. Now we needn't pawn our spoons and studs.
He brought out of his pocket rather a thick bundle of notes, 1,500 rubles, and laid it on the table. Mavra looked at Alyosha with surprise and approval. Natasha eagerly urged him on.
Well, so I wondered what I was to do,
Alyosha went on.
How was I to oppose him? If he'd been nasty to me, I assure you I wouldn't have thought twice about it. I'd have told him plainly I wouldn't, that I was grown up now and a man, and that that was the end of it. And believe me, I'd have stuck to it. But as it is, what could I say to him? But don't blame me. I see you seem displeased, Natasha. Why do you look at one another? No doubt you're thinking, here they've caught him at once, and he hasn't a grain of will. I have will, I have more than you think. And the proof of it is that in spite of my position, I told myself at once, it is my duty. I must tell my father everything, everything, and I began speaking and told him everything, and he listened.
But what? What did you tell him exactly?
Natasha asked anxiously.
Why, that I don't want any other fiancé, and that I have one already. You. That is, I didn't tell him that straight out, but I prepared him for it, and I shall tell him tomorrow. I've made up my mind. To begin with, I said that to marry for money was shameful and ignoble, and that for us to consider ourselves aristocrats was simply stupid. I talked perfectly openly to him as though he were my brother. Then I explained to him that I belonged to the tiers etat, and that the tiers etat c'est l'essential, that I am proud of being just like everybody else, and that I don't want to be distinguished in any way. In fact, I laid all those sound ideas before him. I talked warmly, convincingly. I was surprised at myself. I proved it to him, even from his own point of view. I said to him straight out, "How can we call ourselves princes? It's simply a matter of birth, for what is there princely about us? We're not particularly wealthy, and wealth's the chief point. The greatest prince nowadays is Rothschild. And secondly, it's a long time since anything has been heard of us in real society. The last was Uncle Semyon Volkovsky, and he was only known in Moscow, and he was only famous for squandering his last 300 serfs, and if father hadn't made money for himself, his grandsons might have been ploughing the land themselves. There are princes like that. We've nothing to be stuck up over. In short, I told him everything that I was brimming over with. Everything, warmly and openly. In fact, I said something more. He did not even answer me, but simply began blaming me for having given up going to Count Nainsky's, and then told me I must try and keep in the good graces of Princess K, my godmother, and that if Princess K welcomes me, then I shall be received everywhere, and my career is assured, and he went on and on about that. It was all hinting at my having given up everyone since I've been with you, Natasha, and that's being all your influence. But he hasn't spoken about you directly so far. In fact, he evidently avoids it. We're both fencing, waiting, catching one another, and you may be sure that our side will come off best.
Well, that's all right. But how did it end? What has he decided? That's what matters. And what a chatterbox you are, Alyosha.
Goodness only knows. There's no telling what he's decided. But I'm not a chatterbox at all. I'm talking sense. He didn't settle anything, but only smiled at all my arguments, and such a smile, as though he was sorry for me. I know it's humiliating, but I'm not ashamed of it. I quite agree with you, he said, but let's go to Count Nainsky's, and mind you don't say anything there. I understand you, but they won't. I believe he's not very well received everywhere himself. People are angry with him about something. He seems to be disliked in society now. The Count at first received me very majestically, quite superciliously, as though he'd quite forgotten I grew up in his house. He began trying to remember. He did, really. He's simply angry with me for ingratitude, though really there was no sort of ingratitude on my part. It was horribly dull in his house, so I simply gave up going. He gave my father a very casual reception, too, so casual that I can't understand why he goes there. It all revolted me. Poor father almost has to eat humble pie before him. I understand that it's all for my sake, but I don't want anything. I wanted to tell my father what I felt about it, afterwards, but I restrained myself. And indeed, what would be the good? I shan't change his convictions. I shall only make him angry, and he is having a bad time as it is. Well, I thought, I'll take the cunning and I'll outdo them all. I'll make the Count respect me. And what do you think? I at once gained my object. Everything was changed in a single day. Count Nainsky can't make enough of me now, and that was all my doing, only mine. It was all through my cunning, so that my father was quite astonished.
Listen, Alyosha, you'd better keep to the point,
Natasha cried impatiently.
I thought you would tell me something about us, and you only want to tell us how you distinguished yourself at Count Nainsky's.
Your count is no concern of mine.
No concern? Do you hear, Ivan Petrovich? She says it's no concern of hers. Why, it's the greatest concern. You'll see it is yourself. It will all be explained in the end. Only let me tell you about it. And in fact, why not be open about it? I'll tell you what, Natasha, and you too, Ivan Petrovich, perhaps I really am sometimes very, very injudicious. Granted, even, I'm sometimes stupid, for I know it is so at times. But in this case, I assure you, I showed a great deal of cunning. In fact, of cleverness, so that I thought you'd be quite pleased that I'm not always so stupid.
What are you saying, Alyosha? Nonsense, dear.
Natasha couldn't bear Alyosha to be considered stupid. How often she pouted at me, though she said nothing, when I proved to Alyosha without ceremony that he had done something stupid. It was a sore spot in her heart. She could not bear to see Alyosha humiliated, and probably felt it the more she recognized his limitations. But she didn't give him a hint of her opinion for fear of wounding his vanity. He was particularly sensitive on this point, and always knew exactly what she was secretly thinking. Natasha saw this and was very sorry, and she at once tried to flatter and soothe him. This is why his words now raised painful echoes in her heart.
Nonsense, Alyosha, you're only thoughtless. You're not at all like that, she added. Why do you run yourself down?
Well, that's all right. So let me prove it to you. Father was quite angry with me after the reception at the Count's. I thought, wait a bit. We were driving to the Princess's. I heard long ago that she was so old that she was almost doting, and deaf besides, and awfully fond of little dogs. She has a perfect pack of them and adores them. In spite of all that, she has an immense influence in society, so that even Count Nyinsky, le superbe, does la antechamber to her. So I hatched a complete plan of future action on the way. And what do you think I built it all on? Why, on the fact that dogs always like me. Yes, really, I have noticed it. Either there's some magnetism in me, or else it's because I'm fond of all animals. I don't know. Dogs do like me anyway. And, by the way, talking of magnetism, I haven't told you, Natasha. We called up spirits the other day. I was at a spiritualist's. It's awfully curious, Ivan Petrovich. It really impressed me. I called up Julius Caesar.
My goodness! What did you want with Julius Caesar?
Cried Natasha, going off into a peal of laughter.
That's the last straw.
Why not? As though I were such a... Why shouldn't I call up Julius Caesar? What does it matter to him? Now she's laughing.
Of course it wouldn't matter to him at all. Oh, you dear. Well, what did Julius Caesar say to you?
Oh, he didn't say anything. I simply held up the pencil, and the pencil moved over the paper and wrote of itself. They said it was Julius Caesar writing. I don't believe in it.
But what did he write, then?
Why, he wrote something like the Dip It in Gogol. Do leave off laughing.
Oh, tell me about the princess, then.
Well, you keep interrupting me. We arrived at the princess's, and I began by making love to Mimi. Mimi is a most disgusting, horrid old dog, obstinate, too, and fond of biting. The princess dotes on her. She simply worships her. I believe they're the same age. I began by feeding Mimi with sweetmeats, and in about 10 minutes I had taught her to shake hands, which they had never been able to teach her before. The princess was in a perfect ecstasy. She almost cried with joy. Mimi, Mimi, Mimi is shaking hands. Someone came in. Mimi shakes hands. My godson here has taught her. Count Nyinsky arrived. Mimi shakes hands. She looked at me almost with tears of tenderness. She's an awfully nice old lady. I feel quite sorry for her. I was on the spot then. I flattered her again. On her snuff-box she has her own portrait, painted when she was a bride 60 years ago. Well, she dropped her snuff-box. I picked up the snuff-box and exclaimed, "Quelle charmante peinture!" Just as if I didn't know. It's an ideal beauty. Well, that melted her completely. She talked to me of this and that, asked me where I had been studying and whom I visit, and what splendid hair I had and all that sort of thing. I made her laugh, too. I told her a shocking story. She likes that sort of thing. She shook her finger at me, but she laughed a great deal. When she let me go, she kissed me and blessed me, and insisted I should go in every day to amuse her. The Count pressed my hand. His eyes began to look oily. And as for Father, though he's the kindest and sincerest and most honourable man in the world, if you believe me, he almost cried with joy on the way home. He hugged me and became confidential, mysteriously confidential about a career, connections, marriages, money. I couldn't understand a lot of it. It was then he gave me the money. That was all yesterday.
Tomorrow I'm to go to the princess's again. But still, my father's a very honourable man. Don't you imagine anything? And although he keeps me away from you, Natasha, it's simply because he's dazzled by Katya's millions and wants to get hold of them, and you haven't any. And he wants them simply for my sake, and it's merely through ignorance he is unjust to you. And what father doesn't want his son's happiness? It's not his fault that he has been accustomed to think that happiness is to be found in millions. They're all like that. One must look at him from that standpoint, you know, and no other, and then one can see at once that he's right. I've hurried to come to you, Natasha, to assure you of that, for I know you're prejudiced against him, and of course that's not your fault. I don't blame you for it.
Then all that's happened is that you've made yourself a position at the princess's. Is that all your cunning amounts to?
Asked Natasha.
Not at all. What do you mean? That's only the beginning. I only told you about the princess, because, you understand, through her I shall get a hold over my father. But my story hasn't begun yet.
Well, tell it then.
I've had another adventure this morning, and a very strange one, too. I haven't got over it yet.
Alyosha went on.
You must observe that, although it's all settled about our engagement between my father and the Countess, there's been no formal announcement so far, so we can break it off at any moment without a scandal. Count Nainsky's the only person who knows it, but he's looked upon as a relation and a benefactor. What's more, though I've got to know Katya very well this last fortnight, till this very evening I've never said a word to her about the future, that is, about marriage or love. Besides, it's been settled to begin by asking the consent of Princess K, from whom is expected all sorts of patronage and showers of gold. The world will say what she says. She has such connections. And what they want more than anything is to push me forward in society. But it's the Countess, Katya's stepmother, who insists most strongly on this arrangement. The point is that perhaps the princess so far won't receive her because of her doings abroad, and if the princess won't receive her, most likely nobody else will. So my engagement to Katya is a good chance for her. So the Countess, who used to be against the engagement, was highly delighted at my success with the princess. But that's beside the point. What matters is this. I saw something of Katerina Fyodorovna last year, but I was a boy then, and I didn't understand things, and so I saw nothing in her then.
Simply you loved me more then,
Natasha broke in.
That's why you saw nothing in her. And now...
Not a word, Natasha,
cried Alyosha hotly.
You are quite mistaken and insulting me. I won't even answer you. Listen and you'll see. Ah, if only you knew Katya. If only you knew what a tender, clear, dove-like soul she is. But you will know. Only let me finish. A fortnight ago, when my father took me to see Katya as soon as they had arrived, I began to watch her intently. I noticed she watched me, too. That roused my curiosity, to say nothing of my having a special intention of getting to know her, an intention I had had ever since I got that letter from my father that impressed me so much. I'm not going to say anything about her. I'm not going to praise her. I'll only say one thing. She's a striking contrast to all her circle. She has such an original nature, such a strong and truthful soul, so strong in its purity and truthfulness that I'm simply a boy beside her, like a younger brother, though she is only 17. Another thing I noticed, there's a great deal of sadness about her, as though she had some secret. She's not talkative. At home she's almost always silent, as though afraid to speak. She seems to be brooding over something. She seems to be afraid of my father. She doesn't like her stepmother. I could see that. It's the Countess spreads the story that her stepdaughter is so fond of her, for some object of her own. That's all false. Katya simply obeys her without question, and it seems as though there's some agreement between them about it. 4 days ago, after all my observations, I made up my mind to carry out my intention, and this evening I did. My plan was to tell Katya everything, to confess everything, get her on our side, and so put a stop to it all.
What? Tell her what? Confess what?
Natasha asked uneasily.
Everything, absolutely everything,
answered Alyosha,
and thank God for inspiring me with the thought. But listen, listen. 4 days ago I made up my mind to keep away from you both and stop it all myself. If I had been with you, I should have been hesitating all the time. I should have been listening to you and unable to decide on anything. By remaining alone and putting myself in the position in which I was bound to repeat to myself every minute that I ought to stop it, that I must stop it, I screwed up my courage and have stopped it. I meant to come back to you with the matter settled, and I've come with it settled.
What then? What? What has happened? Tell me quickly.
It's very simple. I went straight to her, boldly and honestly. But I must first tell you one thing that happened just before, and struck me very much. Just before we set off, Father received a letter. I was just going into his study and was standing in the doorway. He did not see us. He was so much overcome by the letter that he talked to himself, uttered some exclamations, walked about the room quite beside himself, and suddenly burst out laughing, holding the letter in his hand. I was quite afraid to go in, and waited for a minute. Father was so delighted about something, so delighted. He spoke to me rather queerly, then suddenly broke off and told me to get ready at once, though it was not time for us to go. They had no one there today, only us two, and you were mistaken, Natasha, in thinking it was a party. You were told wrong.
Oh, do keep to the point, Alyosha, please. Tell me how you told Katya.
Luckily, I was left for 2 hours alone with her. I simply told her that though they wanted to make a match between us, our marriage was impossible, that I had a great affection for her in my heart, and that she alone could save me. Then I told her everything. Only fancy, she knew nothing at all about our story, about you and me, Natasha. If only you could have seen how touched she was. At first, she was quite scared. She turned quite white. I told her our whole story, how for my sake you'd abandoned your home, how we'd been living together, how harassed we were now, how afraid of everything, and that now we were appealing to her. I spoke in your name too, Natasha, that she would take our side and tell her stepmother straight out that she wouldn't marry me, that that would be our one salvation, and that we had nothing to hope for from anyone else. She listened with such interest, such sympathy. What eyes she had at that moment! Her whole soul was in them. Her eyes are perfectly blue. She thanked me for not doubting her, and promised to do all she could to help us. Then she began asking about you, said she wanted very much to know you, asked me to tell you that she loved you already like a sister, and that she hoped you would love her like a sister. And as soon as she heard I had not seen you for 5 days, she began at once urging me to go to you.
Natasha was touched.
And you could tell us first of your triumphs with some deaf princess. Ach, Alyosha!
She exclaimed, looking at him reproachfully.
Well, tell me about Katya. Was she happy, cheerful, when she said goodbye to you?
Yes, she was glad that she was able to do something generous, but she was crying. For she loves me too, Natasha. She confessed that she had begun to love me, that she sees hardly anyone, and that she was attracted by me long ago. She noticed me particularly because she sees cunning and deception all round her, and I seemed to her a sincere and honest person. She stood up and said, "Well, God be with you, Alexei Petrovich." And I was expecting. She burst out crying and went away without saying what. We decided that tomorrow she should tell her stepmother that she won't have me, and that tomorrow I should tell my father everything and speak out boldly and firmly. She reproached me for not having told him before, saying that an honourable man ought not to be afraid of anything. She is such a noble-hearted girl. She doesn't like my father either. She says he's cunning and mercenary. I defended him. She didn't believe me. If I don't succeed tomorrow with my father, and she feels convinced I shan't, then she advises me to get Princess Kay to support me. Then no one would dare to oppose it. We promised to be like brother and sister to each other. Oh, if only you knew her story too, how unhappy she is, with what aversion she looks on her life with her stepmother, all her surroundings. She didn't tell me directly, as though she were afraid even of me, but I guessed it from some words, Natasha, darling. How delighted she would be with you if she could see you. And what a kind heart she has. One is so at home with her. You are created to be sisters and to love one another. I've been thinking so all along. And really, I should like to bring you two together and stand by admiring you. Don't imagine anything, Natasha, little one, and let me talk about her. I want to talk to you about her and to her about you. You know I love you more than anyone, more than her. You're everything to me.
Natasha looked at him caressingly and, as it were, mournfully, and did not speak. His words seemed like a caress, and yet a torment to her.
And I saw how fine Katya was a long time ago, at least a fortnight,
he went on.
I've been going to them every evening, you see. As I went home, I kept thinking of you both, kept comparing you.
Which of us came off best?
Asked Natasha, smiling.
Sometimes you and sometimes she. But you are always the best in the long run. When I talk to her, I always feel I become somehow better, cleverer, and somehow finer. But tomorrow, tomorrow will settle everything.
And aren't you sorry for her? She loves you, you know. You say you've noticed it yourself.
Yes, I am, Natasha. But we'll all three love one another, and then...
And then, goodbye,
Natasha brought out quietly, as though to herself. Alyosha looked at her in amazement. But our conversation was suddenly interrupted in the most unexpected way. In the kitchen, which was at the same time the entry, we heard a slight noise as though someone had come in. A minute later, Mavra opened the door and began nodding to Alyosha on the sly, beckoning to him. We all turned to her.
"Someone's asking for you. Come along," she said in a mysterious voice.
"Who can be asking for me now?"
said Alyosha, looking at us in bewilderment.
"I'm coming."
In the kitchen stood his father's servant in livery. It appeared that the prince had stopped his carriage at Natasha's lodging on his way home and had sent to inquire whether Alyosha were there. Explaining this, the footman went away at once.
"Strange. This has never happened before,"
said Alyosha, looking at us in confusion.
"What does it mean?"
Natasha looked at him uneasily. Suddenly, Mavra opened the door again.
"Here's the prince himself,"
she said in a hurried whisper, and at once withdrew. Natasha turned pale and got up from her seat. Suddenly, her eyes kindled. She stood leaning a little on the table and looked in agitation towards the door by which the uninvited visitor would enter.
"Natasha, don't be afraid. You're with me. I won't let you be insulted,"
whispered Alyosha, disconcerted but not overwhelmed. The door opened, and Prince Valkovsky in his own person appeared on the threshold. Chapter 2. He took us all in a rapid, attentive glance. It was impossible to guess from this glance whether he had come as a friend or as an enemy, but I will describe his appearance minutely. He struck me particularly that evening. I had seen him before. He was a man of 45, not more, with regular and strikingly handsome features, the expression of which varied according to circumstances. But it changed abruptly, completely, with extraordinary rapidity, passing from the most agreeable to the most surly or displeased expression, as though some spring were suddenly touched. The regular oval of his rather swarthy face, his superb teeth, his small, rather thin, beautifully chiselled lips, his rather long, straight nose, his high forehead, on which no wrinkle could be discerned, his rather large grey eyes made him handsome, and yet his face did not make a pleasant impression. The face repelled because its expression was not spontaneous, but always, as it were, artificial, deliberate, borrowed, and a blind conviction grew upon one that one would never read his real expression. Looking more carefully, one began to suspect behind the invariable mask something spiteful, cunning, and intensely egoistic. One's attention was particularly caught by his fine eyes, which were grey and frank-looking. They were not completely under the control of his will, like his other features. He might want to look mild and friendly, but the light in his eyes was, as it were, twofold, and together with the mild, friendly radiance, there were flashes that were cruel, mistrustful, searching and spiteful. He was rather tall, elegantly, rather slimly built, and looked strikingly young for his age. His soft, dark brown hair had scarcely yet begun to turn grey. His ears, his hands, his feet were remarkably fine. It was preeminently the beauty of race. He was dressed with refined elegance and freshness, but with some affectation of youth, which suited him, however. He looked like Alyosha's elder brother. At any rate, no one would have taken him for the father of so grown-up a son. He went straight up to Natasha and said, looking at her firmly,
"My calling upon you at such an hour, and unannounced, is strange and against all accepted rules. But I trust that you will believe I can at least recognize the eccentricity of my behavior. I know, too, with whom I have to deal. I know that you are penetrating and magnanimous. Only give me 10 minutes, and I trust that you will understand me and justify it."
He said all this courteously but with force, and, as it were, emphasis.
"Sit down,"
said Natasha, still unable to shake off her confusion and some alarm. He made a slight bow and sat down.
"First of all, allow me to say a couple of words to him,"
he said, indicating his son.
"As soon as you had gone away, Alyosha, without waiting for me or even taking leave of us, the Countess was informed that Katerina Fyodorovna was ill. She was hastening to her, but Katerina Fyodorovna herself suddenly came in distressed and violently agitated. She told us forthwith that she could not marry you. She said, too, that she was going into a nunnery, that you had asked for her help, and had told her that you loved Natalia Nikolaevna. This extraordinary declaration on the part of Katerina Fyodorovna, especially at such a moment, was of course provoked by the extreme strangeness of your explanation with her. She was almost beside herself. You can understand how shocked and alarmed I was. As I drove past just now, I noticed a light in your window,
he went on, addressing Natasha.
Then an idea which had been haunting me for a long time gained such possession of me that I could not resist my first impulse and came in to see you. With what object? I will tell you directly, but I beg you beforehand not to be surprised at a certain abruptness in my explanation. It is all so sudden.
I hope I shall understand and appreciate what you are going to say as I ought,
answered Natasha, faltering. The prince scrutinized her intently, as though he were in a hurry to understand her through and through in 1 minute.
I am relying on your penetration, too,
he went on.
And I have ventured to come to you now just because I knew with whom I should have to deal. I have known you for a long time now, although I was at one time so unfair to you and did you injustice. Listen, you know that between me and your father there are disagreements of long standing. I don't justify myself. Perhaps I have been more to blame in my treatment of him than I had supposed till now. But if so, I was myself deceived. I am suspicious, and I recognize it. I am disposed to suspect evil rather than good, an unhappy trait, characteristic of a cold heart. But it is not my habit to conceal my failings. I believed in the past all that was said against you, and when you left your parents I was terror-stricken for Alyosha. But then I did not know you. The information I have gathered, little by little, has completely reassured me. I have watched you, studied you, and am at last convinced that my suspicions were groundless. I have learned that you are cut off from your family. I know, too, that your father is utterly opposed to your marriage with my son, and the mere fact that, having such an influence, such power, one may say, over Alyosha, you have not hitherto taken advantage of that power to force him to marry you, that alone says much for you. And yet, I confess it openly, I was firmly resolved at that time to hinder any possibility of your marriage with my son. I know I am expressing myself too straightforwardly, but at this moment straightforwardness on my part is what is most needed. You will admit that yourself when you have heard me to the end. Soon after you left your home I went away from Petersburg, but by then I had no further fears for Alyosha. I relied on your generous pride. I knew that you did not yourself want a marriage before the family dissensions were over, that you were unwilling to destroy the good understanding between Alyosha and me. For I should never have forgiven his marriage with you. That you were unwilling, too, to have it said of you that you were trying to catch a prince for a husband, and to be connected with our family. On the contrary, you showed a positive neglect of us, and were perhaps waiting for the moment when I should come to beg you to do us the honour to give my son your hand. Yet I obstinately remained your ill-wisher. I am not going to justify myself, but I will not conceal my reasons. Here they are. You have neither wealth nor position. Though I have property, we need more. Our family is going downhill. We need money and connections. Though Countess Zinaida Fyodorovna's stepdaughter has no connections, she is very wealthy. If we delayed, suitors would turn up and carry her off. And such a chance was not to be lost. So, though Alyosha is still so young, I decided to make a match for him. You see, I am concealing nothing. You may look with scorn on a father who admits himself that from prejudice and mercenary motives he urged his son to an evil action, for to desert a generous-hearted girl who has sacrificed everyone to him and whom he has treated so badly is an evil action. But I do not defend myself. My second reason for my son's proposed marriage was that the girl is highly deserving of love and respect. She is handsome, well-educated, has a charming disposition, and is very intelligent, though in many ways still a child. Alyosha has no character. He is thoughtless, extremely injudicious, and at 22 is a perfect child. He has at most one virtue, a good heart, positively a dangerous possession with his other failings. I have noticed for a long time that my influence over him was beginning to grow less. The impulsiveness and enthusiasm of youth are getting the upper hand, and even get the upper hand of some positive duties. I perhaps love him too fondly. But I am convinced that I am not a sufficient guide for him. And yet he must always be under some good influence. He has a submissive nature, weak and loving, liking better to love and to obey than to command. So he will be all his life. You can imagine how delighted I was at finding in Katerina Fyodorovna the ideal girl I should have desired for my son's wife. But my joy came too late. He was already under the sway of another influence that nothing could shake, yours. I have kept a sharp watch on him since I returned to Petersburg a month ago, and I notice with surprise a distinct change for the better in him. His irresponsibility and childishness are scarcely altered, but certain generous feelings are stronger in him. He begins to be interested not only in playthings, but in what is lofty, noble, and more genuine. His ideas are queer, unstable, sometimes absurd, but the desire, the impulse, the feeling is finer, and that is the foundation of everything. And all this improvement in him is undoubtedly your work. You have remodeled him. I will confess, the idea did occur to me then, that you, rather than anyone, might secure his happiness. But I dismissed that idea. I did not wish to entertain it. I wanted to draw him away from you at any cost. I began to act, and thought I had gained my object. Only an hour ago I thought that the victory was mine. But what has just happened at the Countess's has upset all my calculations at once, and what struck me most of all was something unexpected. The earnestness and constancy of Alyosha's devotion to you, the persistence and vitality of that devotion, which seemed strange in him. I repeat, you have remodeled him completely. I saw all at once that the change in him had gone further than I had supposed. He displayed today before my eyes a sudden proof of an intelligence of which I had not the slightest suspicion, and at the same time an extraordinary insight and subtlety of feeling. He chose the surest way of extricating himself from what he felt to be a difficult position. He touched and stirred the noblest chords in the human heart, the power of forgiving and repaying good for evil. He surrendered himself into the hands of the being he was injuring, and appealed to her for sympathy and help. He roused all the pride of the woman who already loved him by openly telling her she had a rival, and aroused at the same time her sympathy for her rival, and forgiveness, and the promise of disinterested, sisterly affection for himself. To go into such explanations without rousing resentment and mortification, to do that is sometimes beyond the capacity of the subtlest and cleverest. Only pure young hearts under good guidance can do this. I am sure, Natalia Nikolaevna, that you took no part by word or suggestion in what he did today. You have, perhaps, only just heard of it from him. I am not mistaken, am I?
You are not mistaken,
Natasha assented. Her face was glowing, and her eyes shone with a strange light, as though of inspiration. Prince Valkovsky's eloquence was beginning to produce its effect.
I haven't seen Alyosha for 5 days, she added. He thought of all this himself, and carried it all out himself.
"Exactly so," said Prince Valkovsky. "But in spite of that, all this surprising insight, all this decision and recognition of duty, this creditable manliness, in fact, is all the result of your influence on him. I had thought all this out, and was reflecting on it on my way home, and suddenly felt able to reach a decision. The proposed match with the Countess's stepdaughter is broken off, and cannot be renewed. But if it were possible, it could never come to pass. What if I have come to believe that you are the only woman that can make him happy, that you are his true guide, that you have already laid the foundations of his future happiness? I have concealed nothing from you, and I am concealing nothing now. I think a great deal of a career, of money, of position, and even of rank in the service. With my intellect, I recognize that a great deal of this is conventional, but I like these conventions, and am absolutely disinclined to run counter to them. But there are circumstances when other considerations have to come in, when everything cannot be judged by the same standard. Besides, I love my son dearly. In short, I have come to the conclusion that Alyosha must not be parted from you, because without you he will be lost. And must I confess it? I have perhaps been coming to this conclusion for the last month, and only now realize that the conclusion is a right one. Of course, I might have called on you tomorrow to tell you all this, instead of disturbing you at midnight. But my haste will show you perhaps how warmly, and still more, how sincerely I feel in the matter. I am not a boy, and I could not at my age make up my mind to any step without thinking it over. Everything had been thought over and decided before I came here. But I feel that I may have to wait some time before you'll be convinced of my sincerity. But to come to the point... Shall I explain now why I came here? I came to do my duty to you, and solemnly, with the deepest respect, I beg you to make my son happy and to give him your hand. Oh, do not imagine that I have come like an angry father who has been brought at last to forgive his children and graciously to consent to their happiness. No, no, you do me an injustice if you suppose I have any such ideas. Do not imagine either that I reckon on your consent, relying on the sacrifices you have made for my son. No, again. I am the first to declare aloud that he does not deserve you, and, he is candid and good, he will say the same himself. But that is not enough. It is not only this that has brought me here at such an hour. I have come here,
and he rose from his seat respectfully and with a certain solemnity,
I have come here to become your friend. I know I have no right whatever to this, quite the contrary, but allow me to earn the right. Let me hope.
Making a respectful bow to Natasha, he awaited her reply. I was watching him intently all the time he was speaking. He noticed it. He made his speech coldly, with some display of eloquence, and in parts with a certain nonchalance. The tone of the whole speech was incongruous, indeed, with the impulse that had brought him to us at an hour so inappropriate for a first visit, especially under such circumstances. Some of his expressions were evidently premeditated, and in some parts of his long speech, which was strange from its very length, he seemed to be artificially assuming the air of an eccentric man struggling to conceal an overwhelming feeling under a show of humour, carelessness, and jest. But I only made all these reflections afterwards. At the time, the effect was different. He uttered the last words so sincerely, with so much feeling, with such an air of genuine respect for Natasha, that it conquered us all. There was actually the glimmer of a tear on his eyelashes. Natasha's generous heart was completely won. She, too, got up, and, deeply moved, held out her hand to him without a word. He took it and kissed it with tenderness and emotion. Alyosha was beside himself with rapture.
"What did I tell you, Natasha?"
he cried.
"You wouldn't believe me. You wouldn't believe in his being the noblest man in the world. You see for yourself."
He rushed to his father and hugged him warmly. The latter responded as warmly, but hastened to cut short the touching scene, as though ashamed to show his emotion.
"Enough," he said, and took his hat. "I must go. I asked you to give me 10 minutes, and I have been here a whole hour,"
he added, laughing.
"But I leave you with impatient eagerness to see you again as soon as possible. Will you allow me to visit you as often as I can?"
"Yes, yes," answered Natasha. "As often as you can. I want to make haste, to be fond of you,"
she added in embarrassment.
"How sincere you are, how truthful,"
said Prince Valkovsky, smiling at her words.
"You won't be insincere, even to be polite. But your sincerity is more precious than all artificial politeness. Yes, I recognize that it will take me a long, long time to deserve your love."
"Hush, don't praise me. Enough,"
Natasha whispered in confusion. How delightful she was at that moment.
"So be it,"
Prince Valkovsky concluded.
"I'll say only a couple of words of something practical. You cannot imagine how unhappy I am. Do you know I can't be with you tomorrow, neither tomorrow nor the day after? I received a letter this evening of such importance to me, requiring my presence on business at once, that I cannot possibly neglect it. I am leaving Petersburg tomorrow morning. Please do not imagine that I came to you tonight because I should have no time tomorrow or the day after. Of course, you don't think so, but that is just an instance of my suspicious nature. Why should I fancy that you must think so? Yes, my suspicious nature has often been a drawback to me in my life, and my whole misunderstanding with your family has perhaps been due to my unfortunate character. Today is Tuesday. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday I shall not be in Petersburg. I hope to return on Saturday for certain, and I will be with you the same day. Tell me, may I come to you for the whole evening?"
of course,"
cried Natasha.
"On Saturday evening I shall expect you. I shall expect you impatiently."
"Ah, how happy I am! I shall get to know you better and better. But I must go. I cannot go without shaking hands with you, though,"
he added, turning to me.
"I beg your pardon. We are all talking so disconnectedly. I have several times had the pleasure of meeting you, and once, indeed, we were introduced. I cannot take my leave without telling you how glad I should be to renew our acquaintance."
"We have met, it's true," I answered, taking his hand. "But I don't remember that we became acquainted."
"At Prince M.'s last year."
"I beg your pardon, I've forgotten. But I assure you, this time I shall not forget. This evening will always remain in my memory.
Yes, you are right. I feel the same. I have long known that you have been a good and true friend to Natalia Nikolaevna and my son. I hope you three will admit me as a fourth. May I?
He added, addressing Natasha.
Yes, he is a true friend to us, and we must all hold together.
Natasha answered with deep feeling. Poor girl. She was positively beaming with delight that the prince had not overlooked me. How she loved me.
I have met many worshippers of your talent,
Prince Valkovsky went on.
And I know two of your most sincere admirers, the Countess, my dearest friend, and her stepdaughter, Katerina Fyodorovna Filiminov. They would so like to know you personally. Allow me to hope that you will let me have the pleasure of presenting you to those ladies.
You are flattering, though now I see so few people.
But give me your address. Where do you live? I shall do myself the pleasure.
I do not receive visitors, Prince. At least not at present.
But, though I have not deserved to be an exception, I...
Certainly, since you insist, I shall be delighted. I live in Klugen's buildings.
Klugen's buildings?
He cried, as though surprised at something.
What, have you lived there long?
No, not long, I answered, instinctively watching him. I live at number 44.
44? You are living alone?
Quite alone.
Oh, I ask you because I think I know the house. So much the better. I will certainly come and see you, certainly. I shall have much to talk over with you, and I look for great things from you. You can oblige me in many ways. You see, I am beginning straight off by asking you a favour. But, goodbye. Shake hands again.
He shook my hand and Alyosha's, kissed Natasha's hand again, and went out without suggesting that Alyosha should follow him. We three remained overwhelmed. It had all happened so unexpectedly, so casually. We all felt that in one instant everything had changed, and that something new and unknown was beginning. Alyosha, without a word, sat down beside Natasha and softly kissed her hand. From time to time he peeped into her face as though to see what she would say.
Alyosha, darling, go and see Katerina Fyodorovna tomorrow,
she brought out at last.
I was thinking of that myself,
he said.
I shall certainly go.
But perhaps it will be painful for her to see you. What's to be done?
I don't know, dear. I thought of that, too. I'll look round. I shall see. Then I'll decide. Well, Natasha, everything has changed for us now,
Alyosha said, unable to contain himself. She smiled and gave him a long, tender look.
And what delicacy he has. He saw how poor your lodging is and not a word.
Of what?
Why, of your moving or anything,
he added, reddening.
Nonsense, Alyosha. Why ever should he?
That's just what I say. He has such delicacy. And how he praised you. I told you so. I told you. Yes, he's capable of understanding and feeling anything. But he talked of me as though I were a baby. They all treat me like that. But I suppose I really am.
You're a child, but you see further than any of us. You're good, Alyosha.
He said that my good heart would do me harm. How's that? I don't understand. But I say, Natasha, oughtn't I to make haste and go to him? I'll be with you as soon as it's light tomorrow.
Yes, go, darling, go. You are right to think of it. And be sure to show yourself to him, do you hear? And come tomorrow as early as you can. You won't run away from me for 5 days now,
she added slyly with a caressing glance. We were all in a state of quiet, unruffled joy.
Are you coming with me, Vanya?
Cried Alyosha as he went out.
No, he'll stay a little. I've something more to say to you, Vanya. Mind, quite early tomorrow.
Quite early. Good night, Mavra.
Mavra was in great excitement. She had listened to all the prince said. She had overheard it all, but there was much she had not understood. She was longing to ask questions and make surmises. But sometimes she looked serious and even proud. She, too, realized that much was changed. We remained alone. Natasha took my hand and for some time was silent, as though seeking for something to say.
I'm tired,
she said at last in a weak voice.
Listen, are you going to them tomorrow?
Of course.
Tell Mama, but don't speak to him.
I never speak of you to him anyway.
Of course. He'll find out without that. But notice what he says, how he takes it. Good heavens, Vanya, will he really curse me for this marriage? No, impossible.
The prince will have to make everything right, I put in hurriedly. They must be reconciled, and then everything will go smoothly.
My God, if that could only be, if that could only be...
she cried imploringly. "Don't worry yourself, Natasha. Everything will come right. Everything points to it." She looked at me intently.
"Vanya, what do you think of the prince?"
"If he was sincere in what he said, then to my thinking he's a really generous man."
"Sincere in what he said? What does that mean? Surely he couldn't have been speaking insincerely."
"I agree with you," I answered. Then some idea did occur to her, I thought. "That's strange."
"You kept looking at him so intently."
"Yes, I thought him rather strange."
"I thought so too. He kept on talking so... My dear, I'm tired. You know, you'd better be going home. And come to me tomorrow, as early as you can after seeing them. And one other thing, it wasn't rude of me to say that I wanted to get fond of him, was it?"
"No, why rude?"
"And not stupid. You see, it was as much as to say that so far I didn't like him."
"On the contrary, it was very good, simple, spontaneous. You looked so beautiful at that moment. He's stupid if he doesn't understand that, with his aristocratic breeding."
"You seem as though you were angry with him, Vanya. But how horrid I am, how suspicious and vain. Don't laugh at me. I hide nothing from you, you know. Ah, Vanya, my dear, if I am unhappy again, if more trouble comes, you'll be here beside me, I know. Perhaps you'll be the only one. How can I repay you for everything? Don't curse me ever, Vanya."
Returning home, I undressed at once and went to bed. My room was as dark and damp as a cellar. Many strange thoughts and sensations were hovering in my mind, and it was long before I could get to sleep. But how one man must have been laughing at us that moment as he fell asleep in his comfortable bed. That is, if he thought us worth laughing at. Probably he didn't. Chapter 3. At 10 o'clock next morning, as I was coming out of my lodgings, hurrying off to the Ichmenyevs in Vasilyevsky Island, and meaning to go from them to Natasha, I suddenly came upon my yesterday's visitor, Smith's grandchild, at the door. She was coming to see me. I don't know why, but I remember I was awfully pleased to see her. I had hardly had time to get a good look at her the day before, and by daylight she surprised me more than ever. And indeed, it would have been difficult to have found a stranger or more original creature, in appearance anyway. With her flashing black eyes, which looked somehow foreign, her thick, dishevelled black hair, and her mute, fixed, enigmatic gaze, the little creature might well have attracted the notice of anyone who passed her in the street. The expression in her eyes was particularly striking. There was the light of intelligence in them, and at the same time an inquisitorial mistrust, even suspicion. Her dirty old frock looked even more hopelessly tattered by daylight. She seemed to me to be suffering from some wasting, chronic disease that was gradually and relentlessly destroying her. Her pale, thin face had an unnatural, sallow, bilious tinge. But in spite of all the ugliness of poverty and illness, she was positively pretty. Her eyebrows were strongly marked, delicate and beautiful. Her broad, rather low brow was particularly beautiful, and her lips were exquisitely formed with a peculiar, proud, bold line, but they were pale and bloodless. "Ah, you again," I cried. "Well, I thought you'd come. Come in." She came in, stepping through the doorway slowly, just as before, and looked about her mistrustfully. She looked carefully round the room where her grandfather had lived, as though noting how far it had been changed by another inmate. "Well, the grandchild is just such another as the grandfather," I thought. "Is she mad, perhaps?" She still remained mute. I waited.
"For the books,"
she whispered at last, dropping her eyes. "Oh yes, your books. Here they are, take them. I've been keeping them on purpose for you." She looked at me inquisitively, and her mouth worked strangely, as though she would venture on a mistrustful smile. But the effort at a smile passed, and was replaced by the same severe and enigmatic expression.
"Grandfather didn't speak to you of me, did he?"
she asked, scanning me ironically from head to foot. "No, he didn't speak of you, but..."
"Then how did you know I should come? Who told you?"
she asked, quickly interrupting me. "I thought your grandfather couldn't live alone, abandoned by everyone. He was so old and feeble. I thought someone must be looking after him. Here are your books. Take them. Are they your lesson books?"
"No."
"What do you want with them, then?"
"Grandfather taught me when I used to see him."
"Why did you leave off coming, then?"
"Afterwards, I didn't come. I was ill,"
she added, as though defending herself. Tell me, have you a home, a father and mother? She frowned suddenly and looked at me, seeming almost scared. Then she looked down, turned in silence, and walked softly out of the room without deigning to reply, just as she had done the day before. I looked after her in amazement. But she stood still in the doorway.
What did he die of?
She asked me abruptly, turning slightly towards me with exactly the same movement and gesture as the day before, when she had asked after Azorka, stopping on her way out with her face to the door. I went up to her and began rapidly telling her. She listened mutely and with curiosity, her head bowed and her back turned to me. I told her, too, how the old man had mentioned Sixth Street as he was dying. I imagine, I added, that someone dear to him lived there, and that's why I expected someone would come to inquire after him. He must have loved you, since he thought of you at the last moment.
No,
she whispered, almost unconsciously it seemed.
He didn't love me.
She was strangely moved. As I told my story, I bent down and looked into her face. I noticed that she was making great effort to suppress her emotion, as though too proud to let me see it. She turned paler and paler and bit her lower lip. But what struck me especially was the strange thumping of her heart. It throbbed louder and louder so that one could hear it 2 or 3 paces off, as in cases of aneurysm. I thought she would suddenly burst into tears, as she had done the day before, but she controlled herself.
And where is the fence?
What fence?
That he died under.
I will show you, when we go out. But tell me, what do they call you?
No need to.
No need to what?
Never mind, it doesn't matter. They don't call me anything.
She brought out jerkily, seeming annoyed, and she moved to go away. I stopped her. Wait a minute, you queer little girl. Why, I only want to help you. I felt so sorry for you when I saw you crying in the corner yesterday. I can't bear to think of it. Besides, your grandfather died in my arms, and no doubt he was thinking of you when he mentioned Sixth Street, so it's almost as if he left you in my care. I dream of him. Here, I've kept these books for you, but you're such a wild little thing, as though you were afraid of me. You must be very poor and an orphan, perhaps, living among strangers. Isn't that so? I did my utmost to conciliate her, and I don't know how it was she attracted me so much. There was something beside pity in my feeling for her. Whether it was the mysteriousness of the whole position, the impression made on me by Smith, or my own fantastic mood, I can't say, but something drew me irresistibly to her. My words seemed to touch her. She bent on me a strange look, not severe now, but soft and deliberate, then looked down again as though pondering.
Elena,
she brought out unexpectedly, and in an extremely low voice. That's your name, Elena?
Yes.
Well, will you come and see me?
I can't. I don't know. I will,
she whispered, as though pondering and struggling with herself. At that moment, a clock somewhere struck. She started, and with an indescribable look of heartsick anguish, she whispered,
What time was that?
It must have been 10:30. She gave a cry of alarm.
Oh, dear,
she cried, and was making away. But again I stopped her in the passage. I won't let you go like that, I said. What are you afraid of? Are you late?
Yes, yes. I came out secretly. Let me go. She'll beat me,
she cried out, evidently saying more than she meant to, and breaking away from me. Listen, and don't rush away. You're going to Vasilyevsky Island. So am I, to 13th Street. I'm late, too. I'm going to take a cab. Will you come with me? I'll take you. You'll get there quicker than on foot.
You can't come back with me, you can't,
she cried, even more panic-stricken. Her features positively worked with terror at the thought that I might come to the house where she was living. But I tell you, I'm going to 13th Street on business of my own. I'm not coming to your home. I won't follow you. We shall get there sooner with a cab. Come along. We hurried downstairs. I hailed the first driver I met with a miserable droshky. It was evident Elena was in great haste, since she consented to get in with me. What was most baffling was that I positively did not dare to question her. She flung up her arms and almost leapt off the droshky when I asked her who it was at home she was afraid of. What is the mystery, I thought. It was very awkward for her to sit on the droshky. At every jolt, to keep her balance, she clutched at my coat with her left hand, a dirty, chapped little hand. In the other hand, she held her books tightly. One could see that those books were very precious to her. As she recovered her balance, she happened to show her leg, and to my immense astonishment I saw that she had no stockings, nothing but torn shoes. Though I had made up my mind not to question her, I could not restrain myself again. "Have you really no stockings?" I asked. "How can you go about barefoot in such wet weather, and when it's so cold?"
"No,"
she answered abruptly.
"Good heavens, but you must be living with someone. You ought to ask someone to lend you stockings when you go out." "I like it best."
"But you'll get ill. You'll die."
"Let me die."
She evidently did not want to answer and was angry at my question. "Look, this was where he died," I said, pointing out the house where the old man had died. She looked intently, and suddenly, turning with an imploring look, said to me,
"For God's sake, don't follow me. But I'll come. I'll come again. As soon as I've a chance, I'll come."
"Very well. I've told you already I won't follow you. But what are you afraid of? You must be unhappy in some way. It makes me sad to look at you."
"I'm not afraid of anyone,"
she replied, with a note of irritation in her voice. "But you said just now she'll beat me."
"Let her beat me,"
she answered, and her eyes flashed.
Let her,"
she repeated bitterly, and her upper lip quivered and was lifted disdainfully. At last we reached Vasilyevsky Island. She stopped the droshky at the beginning of 6th Street and jumped off, looking anxiously round.
"Drive away. I'll come,"
she repeated, terribly uneasy, imploring me not to follow her.
"Get on. Make haste, make haste."
I drove on, but after driving a few yards further along the embankment, I dismissed the cab, and going back to 6th Street, ran quickly across the road. I caught sight of her. She had not got far away yet, though she was walking quickly and continually looking about her. She even stopped once or twice to look more carefully whether I were following her or not. But I hid in a handy gateway, and she did not see me. She walked on. I followed her, keeping on the other side of the street. My curiosity was roused to the utmost. Though I did not intend to follow her in, I felt I must find which house she lived in, to be ready in case of emergency. I was overcome by a strange, oppressive sensation, not unlike the impression her grandfather had made on me when Azorka died in the restaurant. Chapter 4. We walked a long way, as far as Little Avenue. She was almost running. At last she went into a little shop. I stood still and waited. Surely she doesn't live at the shop, I thought. She did, in fact, come out a minute later, but without the books. Instead of the books, she had an earthenware cup in her hand. Going on a little further, she went in at the gateway of an unattractive-looking house. It was an old stone house of two stories, painted a dirty yellow color and not large. In one of the three windows on the ground floor there was a miniature red coffin, as a sign that a working coffin-maker lived there. The windows of the upper story were extremely small and perfectly square, with dingy green broken panes, through which I caught a glimpse of pink cotton curtains. I crossed the road, went up to the house, and read on an iron plate over the gate, "Madame Bubnov." But I had hardly deciphered the inscription when suddenly I heard a piercing female scream, followed by shouts of abuse in Madame Bubnov's yard. I peeped through the gate. On the wooden steps of the house stood a stout woman, dressed like a working woman, with a kerchief on her head and a green shawl. Her face was of a revolting purplish color. Her little puffy, bloodshot eyes were gleaming with spite. It was evident that she was not sober, though it was so early in the day. She was shrieking at poor Elena, who stood petrified before her with the cup in her hand. A disheveled female, painted and rouged, peeped from the stairs behind the purple-faced woman. A little later, a door opened on the area steps leading to the basement, and a poorly dressed, middle-aged woman of modest and decent appearance came out on the steps, probably attracted by the shouting. The other inhabitants of the basement, a decrepit-looking old man and a girl, looked out from the half-open door. A big, hulking peasant, probably the porter, stood still in the middle of the yard with the broom in his hand, looking lazily at the scene.
"Oh, you damned slut, you bloodsucker, you louse!"
squealed the woman, letting out at one breath all her store of abuse, for the most part without commas or stops, but with a sort of gasp.
So this is how you repay me for the care of you ragged wench. She was just sent for some cucumbers, and off she slipped. My heart told me she'd slip off when I sent her out. My heart ached, it did. Only last night I all but pulled her hair out for it, and here she runs off again today. And where have you to go, you trollop? Where have you to go to? Who do you go to, you damned mummy, you staring viper, you poisonous vermin? Who is it? Speak, you rotten scum, or I'll choke you where you stand.
And the infuriated woman flew at the poor girl, but seeing the woman looking at her from the basement steps, she suddenly checked herself, and, addressing her, squealed more shrilly than ever, waving her arms as though calling her to witness the monstrous crimes of her luckless victim.
Her mother's up the twig. You all know, good neighbours, she's left all alone in the world. I saw she was on your hands, poor folks as you are, though you'd nothing to eat for yourselves. There, thought I, for St. Nikolai's sake, I'll put myself out and take the orphan. So I took her, and would you believe it, here I've been keeping her these 2 months, and upon my word she's been sucking my blood and wearing me to a shadow, the leech, the rattlesnake, the obstinate limb of Satan. You may beat her or you may let her alone, she won't speak. She might have a mouthful of water the way she holds her tongue. She breaks my heart holding her tongue. What do you take yourself for, you saucy slut, you green monkey? If it hadn't been for me, you'd have died of hunger in the street. You ought to be ready to wash my feet and drink the water, you monster, you black French poker. You'd have been done but for me.
But why are you upsetting yourself so, Anna Trifonovna? How's she vexed you again?
Respectfully inquired the woman who had been addressed by the raving fury.
You needn't ask, my good soul, that you needn't. I don't like people going against me. I am one for having things my own way, right or wrong. I'm that sort. She's almost sent me to my grave.